Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Vonna Pfeiffer.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for people who do the fine art needle and thread thing. Our guest this week, Jacob DeGroff of Modern Folk Embroidery. Hi, Jacob.
Hello.
Okay, now I said it the American way. You got to say your last name the real way.
So it's pronounced DeGroff.
There. But... See, that's beautiful. See, we there. Do that one more time just for me.
DeGroff.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. I feel better. I got to stick with DeGroff because I could never pull that off. So
no worries. Thank you guys for having me today.
Oh, thanks for doing this. This, of course, it's always fun to talk with males who do needlework because we're a very small minority in this world, but
there's not many of us, yeah. No.
So where do you learn needlework?
Well, I discovered that I had been doing it longer than I thought I had been doing it. okay. While I was back in the Netherlands, I found some stitching when I was about 10 years old. And I actually started designing then myself, which I had completely forgotten. And I found a little booklet with little drawings in it, with sort of folk pattern. So it has always been something that I've liked. But yeah, that was the first time that I started stitching. But because it's quite easy to learn, I think my mom might have shown how to do one or two stitches, and she might have told me, like, just make sure that they're always in the same direction. And from there, it was just working on it. But then I didn't do it for years. And then a couple of years ago, when I was in the Netherlands, I saw an antique stitching piece and sort of really sparked me wanting to get back into it again. Yeah.
Yeah. See, that's interesting. I forget who I was talking to recently here, where you talk about help young people getting involved in stitching, and you know, they may not keep it up. Life gets in the way, you know, kids move on and do kid things, but it's still there. And then, you know, you're a perfect example. It sounds like of someone who came back later and it appealed to you then. And then, let me try that again. And
exactly. Yeah, no, it was something that I had always had an interest in it. And I've always had an interest in crafts, and I've always been doing things and making things, but cross stitch somehow, it sort of vanished to the background and I've forgotten about it. And then it wasn't until I was looking at, because I've studied fine arts, and I was looking at some old paintings, and I was looking at stitching on old paintings, and got fascinated by that and tried to copy bits from that. And then looking at antique embroidery piece at my mom's house, and I was like, hey, you know what? I want to get back into this. And I started actually my little company called Modern Folk Embroidery when I was charting that antique piece and stitching it up and discovering how much joy I found in doing the whole designing process and making things. And then I thought, like, you know what, I can actually make up my own designs instead of just copying something that's been before. But that was only intention for myself, for my own joy. And then people saw it and they said, like, you know what, you should start selling these. And that's kind of how it started, selling a few patterns on Etsy in the beginning. And that really started things off for me.
That's interesting when that light goes on. Wait a minute, I can do this. I can design this.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, and it fitted so neatly in what I was sort of working on at the time as well, looking at patterns and looking at history and things like that. So it all fitted perfectly together. So it really came together in a way that I thought, like, yeah, this is something I really want to pursue and try and do professionally if I can as well, yeah.
Yeah. And fine art background, so you actually have schooling and training?
Yes. I studied fine arts in the Netherlands, graduated from a school in Kampen, doing painting. So I had several exhibitions in the Netherlands, and I had a little gallery for a couple of years before moving to the UK. I still do painting and drawing and things like that, but it's gone to the background, actually, because now I'm doing my design stuff full time. And I'm part-time artist now.
Does your painting training, do you find that come into play as you make designs, or is it really just the basics of art that serve you with the needlework designs?
Yeah, I think the having a background in art and art history really does help, because it sort of, I do have a natural interest in really looking and reading in old things and going to museums and you know, sort of looking at slightly different things than someone else might be looking at when trying to design something. So I like going to museums like the V&A and take pictures of old sculptures and architecture examples there, and then thinking like, hey, you know what, that old pillar with like two birds on top of it really looks interesting. Maybe I can use this and look at the art history behind it and the stories of travel through Europe and bring these things then together in a pattern. So you sort of blend things together, and I think it does help when you have a little bit of an overview of art history and a little bit of understanding of styles and things like that. So yeah, I think it does it has definitely helped me in that way. Yeah.
And but the painting has just faded away. Was it oil painting, acrylics? What?
Yeah. Well, I paint in oils mainly, but it's something that I still do. But it's more like a personal thing that I do now. I'm not really pursuing any huge exhibitions or anything like that, but I just do it for my own pleasure now, which is great. Yeah.
And then if it's really garbage, you just throw it away.
Exactly. Nobody, yeah.
Nobody will ever see it. Yeah. So the because that's the part about your designs. I mean, you have such a unique style with your designs. Yeah. And then you mentioned somewhere I read where you like to have there's some history behind them, a story behind them. Talk about that in your designs, how you try to tell a story or how history plays a role.
Definitely, yeah. No, I find it very important that the patterns themselves actually tell a story and that there is a story behind it, because I think it's quite interesting when you're working on something and you can share stories about architecture, about history, about social changes and these things, and sort of incorporate them in patterns. So when I look at patterns, I do try and tell a little bit in the design booklets as well, so the stitcher gets an idea of not just following the little crosses on a pattern, but also learning a little bit about the history of either embroidery or art at some points and stuff. So yeah, and I think it's quite interesting to tell these stories through my samplers as well, because I've done some historical samplers. But when I do them, I really try and research who made them, what were the stories behind these people, where did they live, which is tricky with samplers because a lot of the time you don't really know a lot about them. But I do try and give these samplers a story and a backstory. So there's more than just following a pattern. There is more like a story behind it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do both. You do original creations and reproduction samplers.
Yes, I do.
Most people migrate to one or the other.
Yes.
Is it the history that keeps you interested in both, or how does that work?
No, it is indeed. Yeah, I started purely making original patterns, and they were inspired by Scandinavian folk art things. But when you do something and you start sort of broadening your horizon, the more you work, and I've been doing this for, I think, 8 years now. Yeah, I think it's been 8 years now that I've since I started Modern Folk. And your view expands, so it's not just Scandinavian patterns anymore. It becomes different styles, and you learn different stories, and then you start buying samplers, and you start buying more samplers. So now I've got quite a nice little collection of antique samplers, and I buy them when they really speak to me. So I don't tend to buy really expensive, fancy samplers with meticulous stitching that cost thousands of pounds. They're usually quite folksy, simple samplers that really appeal to me. But there has to be a story there. So when I have to fall in love with them. And so, yeah, for me, it's sort of a natural progression to do these adaptations as well.
I think that's what drew me to your designs when I, you know, felt you kind of fell into my lap. I saw I guess, people stitching them on Instagram. And that's what spoke to me every time I saw one of your samplers being stitched, is the simplicity of the look, but how, you know, almost very intricate the design work was, but yet overall it just draws your eyes right to it, because it's just, you know, most of your samplers are all just single color thread, correct?
Yes. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what's so, that's just what, to me, it's just a stunning piece of work. Just everything that I've ever seen stitched up has just been a stunning piece of work that you've done in design work for that.
Thank you so much. That's really nice that you say that, because that is something that I try to do with the work as well. But I've been really fortunate as well. As you mentioned, a lot of people share my work, which is which is really nice, because it is, when you're a designer, you just sit behind a computer, basically. at least I work on a computer, and you click little squares on the screen and you make something. And sadly, I don't have the time to actually stitch everything up myself, but it is really, really lovely to see that when it goes out there, people share it, and that's something that's really wonderful. And then to read as well the stories that people share when they make it, which is really, really nice to see how people interpret the work or how they change things as well, which is really exciting for me to see as a designer, how people add, you know, like little sayings and things to samplers that I've designed, change wording of things, sometimes completely change color, like make it really colorful and playful. And I do like that. I think that's a very beautiful thing, because it fits with the idea of folk art as well. It's not, my patterns are monochrome. Like you said, they're very simple in a way, like it's just one color. And I kind of like that people just play with that and run with it and just do their own thing, which fits like in a folk art tradition.
Right.
Yeah.
It's beautiful work. It's just, I have looked several times over his website all the time. And I have bought the 2019 Sal parts, you know, the stitch along parts. And there's one lady on Instagram that, and I should have looked her name up before we came on air, but she has added color to the 2019 one, and she always does posts on the hashtag modern folk embroidery. Yes. 2019 style. It is beautiful. What she has done with your patterns is beautiful. You know, I mean, it honestly is. And she's added color, but then the other ones, in conversely, who have just done it in monochromatic threads, it's also beautiful. So I would imagine as a designer that is very satisfying to see people take your work and interpret it maybe the same way you interpret it, but then others add other colors, and just to see the vast array of what people have done. I'm certain that that's very satisfying as a designer to see that. And just to see it on Instagram as a whole body of work from all over the world, people stitching, is just, you know, I would encourage anybody to look up that hashtag, because it's just very, very inspiring to see that.
It is indeed. And what I know the lady you mean, I think she's an artist from the UK.
Yes, yes, yes. That's exactly who it is. Yeah.
She makes really, really wonderful illustrations and drawings and paintings. So, yeah, she's definitely worth following as well. So if people follow the hashtag, definitely look it up, because there's some really wonderful stuff that people make.
Yes.
Use of color is really, really lovely. She's stitching it on a dark fabric, I believe, at the moment.
Yes, she is. Like, it's almost like a navy blue or a very, it's not black, I don't think. I think it's like a blue gray or something. Very beautiful what she's done.
It's really stunning, that one. Definitely. Yeah.
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 In this world of a billion colors and a billion threads, what is it about doing it in monochrome? Is it because your mind wants to see the shape and design and the color is really not relevant to what you're doing, or you just prefer one color? What?
Well, that started actually because the first pattern I saw that I really fell in love with, and that started Modern Folk Embroidery as well, that was a monochrome pattern. And a lot of really colorful patterns have never really appealed to me. That doesn't say that I don't like colorful work, because I've actually started stitching some colorful work myself. But it's the shape and the simplicity of monochrome work, because when you only use one color, you can only do outlines of things. So you have to work really with the fabric and with the stitching itself. So you can't sort of decide like, oh, you know, I'm going to put lots of stitches, because then you would just have a huge blob of one color. You really have to make choices of how are you going to use those little stitches and what are you going to do with them. And in a lot of folk art, the folk art that I really admire, it tends to be monochrome or very simple in line, and that really lends itself perfectly for monochrome sampler. So it's a combination of the shapes, and the patterns that really do it for me, and that's, yeah.
Yeah, because it works. I mean, it's Vanna's fault that I even know about you, because she said you have to talk to this guy. But you know, I found myself just in researching for this, just sitting there and immersing myself in the various design patterns that you have and the way that they flow from the center out, and then as you know, each element and how it works with the other. And it really is just, you know, there is no color. Color just goes away completely, no matter what color thread you did them in. It just goes away, and at least I found myself just immersed in the patterns and how they flow and just the visual journey around it, that it really works well. It's a real treat to look at them.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I think, and that's the cool thing as well, because you have only these two elements. You have the color of your fabric, which is then suddenly really important as well. And you've got that single one color that you stitch with, which gives it such huge possibilities for the stitches themselves to just play around and do whatever they can do with it, which is, yeah, which I find really exciting to, yeah.
I've yet to do a Quaker sampler. Vanna, have you done a Quaker sampler?
Yes.
Oh, yes, I've done 50.
No, I have. I have done the Quaker stocking, remember? And yep. I've done a couple. None are all, they're like usually in, the ones that I have done are usually in like two or three colors. So you have like most of them, like is in one of that I've done there, it's mostly all red, but just there's a few motifs that are just splotches of gold. And I've never done a full monochrome Quaker, but I just have to say, Jacob, that's exactly what drew me to you, was your Quakers. Your Quakers are just absolutely gorgeous.
Thank you so
and
much.
What I really like too is that you usually see a lot of samplers, monochrome samplers done in red or in blue. And what really intrigues me and just draws your eye every time are the ones where you've done like a slate gray or brown tan background with white thread. And how hard is it to stitch with white thread? And you have done just fantastic work with the darker background fabrics with white thread. I mean, they're just absolutely stunning.
Your Anyus Day.
Oh my goodness. I almost had my finger hovering over that button yesterday to buy the Anyus Day sampler. It is absolutely stunning. And your story on your website about it being the hunger cloth, and it's just you can tell that your art history and the way you design, and like you said, your stories that you tell, it just draws you in and it makes you want to stitch your pieces, and they're just beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, the Agnes Day one was really actually quite a fun project to work on, because that's one of the few patterns that I started with Modern Folk Embroidery that was actually not a it's a design that I did, but it is sort of copied from a stamp-sized image that I found in an embroidery book. And it didn't say anything about it. It just had a really, really small picture. It was like a thumbnail. It was really, really small. And you couldn't really see anything. But I was just really fascinated by that lamb in the middle and the text around it. And those beautiful, really intricate sort of leaf borders. So I thought, like, you know, can I, because I wanted to stitch it myself because I loved it so much. So I started designing it, and I thought, like, when it was finished, I thought, like, I should really share this design with other people, because it is a really lovely design, and I'm really happy with how it actually turned out in the end. But it was a lot of work. It took me a couple of years stitching. I started it, and then as it goes, it just sort of disappears in a drawer, doesn't it? And it just sits there. But then I think it was maybe 2 years ago now, we were traveling by train through Europe, and I thought, like, you know what, this is a perfect opportunity to just dig it out again and finish it. So I set myself a goal: before we reach home, I have to finish this. So I took it with me, stitched on a train, met some really wonderful people when you travel as well, talking about stitching and about the Hungertuch, they call it in German, the hunger cloth. Which was interesting because we were traveling through Germany, so there were some German people, and they knew all about it. And
yeah, tell what that is, because I learned something reading about that. Tell about that.
Yeah, so it's a piece that is hung on the altar during the period of Lent. So it is really an Easter decoration in the church traditionally. And the Agnus Dei, it literally means the Lamb of God, and then there's the Latin prayer around it from the Mass, but it's a really beautiful tradition of having that in the church and displaying that just for that period. But I just love the sentiment of that beautiful lamb, and going when I was working on the sampler as well, I started discovering the whole little decorative ornaments on the sampler, and they all tell the whole Passion story, which is quite interesting. So there's the dyes that were thrown, and there's the cloth itself, the dress, there's a spear, there's nails, the stigmata signs are there in little icons. It's the whole story of the Passion, which is quite beautiful when you look at it. So it's like a proper a story that's being told on a cloth, where people could look at it and they could see the story for themselves as well, because of course this is a cloth, I think it's from 16 something, this one. And that's still from a period when the majority of people wouldn't be able to read or write. So they would go into a church and the stories would be told through images. And this is one of those remnants of really telling a story through very clear, nearly like pictograms. They're really simple. And I really liked that. And that was really what drew me through that to that design as well. Yeah.
Well, I'm of German descent and I am Roman Catholic. And as a Catholic, you know, I can remember very vividly as a little girl when I was receiving my first communion, that cloth hung on the tabernacle in my church. one very similar. I can just still see the sheep. So when I or the lamb. So when I saw that design. And I read your story, and you know that you told so beautifully, and you've told it again so beautifully here with us. It's just what a wonderful body of work that is for, you know, people that are Christian or whatever. Because that's just a beautiful, what you've done is you brought something historically back to life, and have told a beautiful story that people are not likely to hear, you know, every day. So it's just beautiful. It's just absolutely gorgeous. And I'm definitely going to get the pattern now that I've heard your story, because it's touched me.
Thank you.
It's very, it's a beautiful, that was one of the first things that I saw when I went to your website. And I was just shocked at how beautiful it is. And it is. It is exactly, I knew exactly what it was when I saw it. And I remembered that, you know, how you think of things when you were a child and how they seem so bigger and in your mind than what they are in real life.
Yes.
I was shocked at how not diminutive, that's because it's not at all a diminutive sampler what you stitched there. but I feel like in my mind it was like as big as the altar, you know, being a child, you know.
Definitely, it could have definitely been, because I think the original sampler that I based it on, I think it might have been a crochet piece.
Yeah.
Is it called retinella, I think, or something, that open worked squared?
Yeah, or fillet. It might be like fillet cross stitch fillet crochet.
Exactly.
That's what ours were. That's what the one at my church was. Yes. I'm certain it was like a crochet.
That's what I think that one was as well. So this is basically a pattern based on that.
Yeah.
And you could even use the design. That's the nice thing as well about these monochrome samplers, that you can use them for knitting, you can use them for crocheting. Mm-hmm. If you do that kind of design, I've seen someone knit things that I've designed, which is quite spectacular to see something like ending up on a little woolly hat, and you go like, hey, I designed that. That's really cool. So yeah, it is really amazing what you can do with monochrome patterns and how you can adapt them. But yeah, I think the original one that was on the altar, it would have definitely been a lot bigger to really be viewed for the whole community and not just like up close.
Okay, all right. I'm the Lutheran outcast in this group, so I know nothing. What is the purpose? You know, and of course, is now off on the tangent, but I got to know, what is the purpose or the symbolism of this hunger cloth? What?
It's a decorative item that you put out during the period of Lent, because this is, of course, because I'm from the Netherlands and I grew up a Dutch Reformed, but these things in Germany and in other Catholic countries, they would have been hung on the altar during that period. And the aim is to tell that story as a decoration for that period. These days, a lot of churches just have a cross with a cloth hanging on the cross itself. During the Easter period. So it is just one of those things that you put in a church just for that period. And once it's over, they would take that down again and something else would come in its place. So for Christmas, they would have a different type of cloth, for instance. Yeah.
And they usually have it. Usually they bring like the kids that are going to be brought into the church with First Communion. That's usually done sometime in the period waning between Easter and Ascension Day, and they'll leave that cloth up for the first communicants. And a lot of times they'll take it down like right after that.
Exactly, so. Yeah. Because it would explain the name a hunger cloth as well, because it would be in the period of fasting. So it would,
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's what I was trying. I was trying to figure out how hunger got into it. So period of fasting, that's where that comes. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Now I'm clicking. Okay. Us Lutherans don't do that stuff. So, you know, Martin Luther got mad and, you know, we've just been mad ever since. So, you know, we just walk around with a chip on our shoulder. We can't help it. Yeah. So I wanted to get back to Quaker samplers. They fascinate me because they're beautiful. I've never done one, but they're beautiful. But what fascinates me is the design aspect. Because it looks to me like you could have a box full of shapes and just sit there and just move them around on a board. And
it's funny that you're mentioning that, because that's actually what I will be doing with the upcoming stitch along.
Oh.
There will be one pattern. I'm giving that away kind of now, but it will not be next month, but the one after that, I think. Or is it the one month after that? One of those months, anyway, there will be a pattern which I will give an option for people to stitch as it is, but I really want to encourage people giving them a whole set of small patterns, cutting them out, and just play around with them on a graph paper. And what you're saying about the Quaker samplers, I think that might have been how they would have originally designed them as well, just playing around with little shapes and forms and putting them around, because they do tend to borrow little medallions from one sampler to another. So there's a lot of similarities in the antique samplers that share patterns, but always in different shapes and forms. So they're not stuck to a particular way of like, this is a Quaker, and then and you'll see one exactly like it. So there's not a single one is exactly the same. So they're always really playful. And the antique ones, they are really beautiful and very different from one another. There's a school quite close to where we live here in York, which is very famous, the Ackworth School, of the Society of Friends, because the Quakers are actually called Friends. That's how they refer to themselves. But the samplers, the most famous ones, are actually were made in this school, and I've been really, really fortunate of actually finding an antique Quaker sampler in an antique shop that was made in 1795 by a girl named Sarah Storrs, and she made a beautiful, colourful sampler. And when I saw it in the antique shop, it was really quite grubby on the glass of the sampler, so I couldn't really see what it was. And I falsely assumed that it was like a lady who had made something in the 80s because it was very colourful. And I thought, like, I'd never seen that on a Quaker sampler being so colourful. I thought this must be something new. And when I was on the train back home, I sort of put a bit of the grime away from the picture frame, and I sort of, my heart skipped a beat because I suddenly saw a year stitched in white threads on the white linen, and it said 1795. And the worst thing was that I only paid £12 for this sampler. And yes, since then I learned that this is actually, it is a genuine Quaker sampler. It was made in Yorkshire by a girl named Sarah Storrs, who attended the Ackworth School. And so, yeah, I've been really fortunate of actually having one Quaker sampler in my collection. Even though she didn't finish it, it is still a really beautiful dated and signed sampler, which is one of my most prized samplers in my collection. Yeah.
You got it for next to nothing.
I got it for next to nothing, I didn't realize that it was that special when I purchased it, actually. I thought it was like a cheap,
right,
sort of new unfinished thing. I thought it was, it's curious, I'll just buy that, it'll be fun, you know. And no idea that I actually had bought a really special antique sampler.
Wow.
that was quite exciting, definitely.
Well played.
Yeah. But what really appeals to me as well with the Quaker samplers is the idea of the Quakers themselves. They're a very peaceful group of people. They really preach a lot of tolerance, and I like they've got quite a nice structure where people join in a meeting and everyone can have their say, and they don't have a sermon per se, they just speak to one another. And when you look at the writings of the Quakers and you start reading their texts a little bit, it's really quite fascinating, and it really struck a chord with me. And I think it's a really nice thing that we can use in this day and age, especially to, you know, talk about tolerance and talk about basically being kind to one another. And that's something that you always see very much in Quaker samplers. So a lot of the names of my samplers I borrow from either old writings by Quakers, and little things like a token of love, for instance. That's one that you see a lot on antique samplers, and words like unity, love. Uh-huh. Peace and tenderness, for instance, those are all words that really, I think they're beautiful, and they're beautiful sentiments. And no matter what someone's beliefs are, I think that's something that's just such a universal, beautiful idea. That's really something that really appeals to me with the Quaker samplers, especially. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, see, this is going to sound really weird, but, you know, when you describe that Quakers were not having a sermon and everybody just speaking. Then yes. I look at the sampler, and my mind, this is just what my mind did, was it went to, okay, so this collection of shapes in a Quaker sampler almost represents a collection of people sitting in a room of all makes, shapes, and sizes, all having a say in the overall package.
I really like that idea, actually. I think that's a beautiful sentiment, actually. Yeah, definitely. And I think, the idea that how they developed is not really certain as well. There's only one sampler known from the early 18th century, I believe, that is like a Quaker sampler with medallions. But for the rest, they're all late 18th century and onwards. And what the origins are completely unknown. They do think that they're inspired by European samplers, but how they got to what they are now, it's a bit of a mystery. But I like your idea of having basically this sort of, this jumbled together group of elements like they have in their meetings. Yeah, that's quite a nice idea, actually. Yeah.
Well, it gives meaning to me for these things. Of all the samplers, though I've never done one, Quakers are the ones that catch my eye every time. They really...
Yeah, I agree. Me too. And just listening to Jacob talk, you have such a nice voice. I said this to Gary whenever we hung up earlier. I said, you have such a nice voice.
Oh, but, thank you.
it almost is a sense of tranquility, don't you think? Like peace and tranquility when you look at those samplers. At least it is to me when I look at yours, because yours are very balanced. And, you know, some of the Ackworth samplers and Quaker samplers can be a little unbalanced, you know, just like here's a medallion, there's a medallion. And yours, some of them, not all of them, but yours are just they're balanced to the eye. And with your white thread, again, I'm hitting on the white thread, but that is just to me is just like peaceful or tranquil or something. That's what it brings to my mind. And Gary, your whole idea with the people in the room and speaking what they, you know, can you just imagine that? That was, I mean, that's just a great analogy, I think.
I definitely think that is a beautiful analogy. And mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it is interesting because it is basically, they're two things, aren't they? They're really busy and wild and chaotic in a way, but because they're monochrome and because they're basically the same type of shape, constantly these sort of round medallion shapes, there is like a repetitiveness that actually works in a really calming and peaceful way as well.
Mm-hmm.
Which is funny because it should be, when you look at them and you look at the individual parts, they're quite wild and quite out there, some of them, aren't they? Like the big star patterns and the birds and things. But I think all together, because it does repeat, it is kind of calm. And there is something quite interesting. I visited the exhibition of British folk art back in 2014 at the Tate in London. And the accompanying booklet was quite fascinating because they were talking about folk art and the idea of horror vacui, the fear of empty space. And that's something that you see particularly in folk art, where people just have to fill in the whole space. They don't want any cloth to be seen. It just has to be filled with tiny patterns. And I think that's something that really appeals to me with Quaker patterns as well, that when you look at the old samplers, like if they have like three medallions and there's a bit of space in between the medallions, let's just stick a tiny bird in there or a tiny little flower or something, or an alphabet or a letter or something. But there has to be something in that space. It cannot be empty. And that's something that I find really beautiful. And it's really, actually, as a designer, it is really satisfying to play around with these shapes and design these medallions and then move them around over your canvas. When I design, I do design them usually as they end up. I don't really move too much with them. So it is sort of like how girls would have stitched them as well. They most, at least I believe that they would have started because the unfinished samples always show the outer edge first. So they started on the outer edge. They just started making medallions and they would fit in whatever fitted. And then they would do the center. And that's roughly how I started designing them myself, which kind of works. And then just filling it all up, just no space left.
Mm-hmm. All right, now the time is going to get away from us, and we got a million other things. So I want to get to the stitch-alongs.
And yes.
Now this is the second one this year?
This is the second one, yes, it is. Last year I did one, which was the Four Seasons sampler, which was a Quaker-style sampler, but it's sort of played with other folk art styles as well. And for this year, I've done a proper 12-month, 12 panels, centered around the idea of hope. And the jumping point was a beautiful poem by Emily Dickinson called Hope is the Thing with Feathers. And it's a really lovely poem. And I thought that was such a beautiful sentiment as well, that like a bird is something that gives people hope. It is something, when you see it, it is something really beautiful. I think Emily Dickinson saw herself as a bird as well. That was what she had in her mind as well. And I thought that would be a really beautiful thing to stitch for people as well, to stitch something about hope and about positivity and work on that as a kind of a meditation for 12 months. So, yeah.
Oh, no. Okay. That changes it for me there. Looking at it as a meditation.
Yeah. I think it,
Man, I hate this because now, see, I'm going to want to do this one too.
Yeah, but I think that's the beauty, isn't it? Of CrossFit is such a meditative medium, and I think when you give it meaning by I've done this in the past as well, where I had like a freebie pattern that I've given away, which is still available on my website. People can still purchase. Well, they don't have to purchase it. They just put it in their shopping cart, and at the checkout they get a free pattern. But there's a couple of freebies there, and I particularly designed them because I thought it would be really nice to put out a nice positive image that people can use and that they can reflect on, like a meditation, because it is a nice meditative exercise to do stitching, but especially when what you stitch actually has like a meaning as well. I've got one pattern called Let's Be Kind, and it's nice to just think about what can we do for other people to be kinder to one another. And I think that's quite an important thing that we, especially in this day and age, that we need to think about a bit
more.
Yeah,
you think? Yeah, just maybe we ought to try that once in a while. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
What inspired you to start the Stitch Along last year? Was it just something to try?
Well, I had been asked years ago, because it's been going for quite a few years now, the Stitch Alongs, haven't they? And I didn't know what it was. That was the funny thing, because I'm a bit of an odd person. I tend not to look too much about what is going on out there. I just sort of live in my own little bubble and I make my own little things. And it's usually when customers write to me and they say, like, you know what, you should do this, you should look up this, or, you know, maybe you can do something like that. And then I think, like, I've never heard of that. Sal, what's Sal? So I had to look up, like, what is a Sal? And then I started looking at these things and I thought, like, you know what, this is exactly what would be really interesting, because I've got such a lovely community of people that I've built up over the years that make my patterns. And I thought it would be really fascinating to see if we made something together and shared it online. And that started happening, which I'm really grateful for. And it's been such a wonderful experience last year. And people still are starting last year's Sal as well and stitching it up in groups. And yeah, it's become a really nice exercise of people getting together and stitching. And when they can't get physically together, then to just do it online with other people. And I think that's a really beautiful thing to do. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I do too. And I think that's what, you know, it has brought stitching. Social media has played, you know, a huge part in stitching, I think.
Definitely.
And yeah. And I mean, that's how I found your designs, and, you know, and I told Gary about it, and now we're interviewing you. And I mean, it's just made me really fall in love with your designs more, just hearing you speak about them. And I think that is just a beautiful way to look at a stitch along. You know, we all are different parts of the spoke of a wheel, but we're all a part of a wheel, and something brings us all together, and that's our love for needle and thread. And what a beautiful way to think about a stitch along. I never thought of it in those terms, but that's exactly what it is. It's bringing different elements all together cohesively.
Absolutely.
In a circle. So thanks for sharing that. I appreciated that.
No,
because I never thought of it that way.
That was what really appealed to me, that, you know, it's and what I find really beautiful about it as well is people get in touch with each other who would never have spoken to each other otherwise.
Right.
So there will be people, there's like a lady in India who stitches along, and then there's a lady in Canada and a lady in South America, and there's the people in the UK and in Japan and everywhere. All these people suddenly come together, and they are from completely different backgrounds, different religious systems or no religious systems. It's so fascinating to see all these people come together, and they're all working on the same pattern, because I think that, and that's a really beautiful, positive thing to do something together and respect each other and see that there's so much more that sort of brings us together than that separates us, really, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, Jacob, I'm gonna offer you a time saving tip. Yeah, just take your entire catalog, bundle it up, throw in a bill, and send it to Vanna, and then it'll just be over with. It's just going to save you a lot of time and hassle. It really is. You know, I'm just There's no charge for that tip. It's just
I like your thinking, yeah. Gary.
It's going to happen eventually, so just save yourself all of that. Yeah. All right, now I got to get to the music because when I was doing research for this and going through your website, and you have some samples of your music from your album, I guess, Ivy, and I have to say I put it on and started listening. And then I just opened another window so I could go through your website and just let that music cycle through. It's really beautiful stuff. Tell about how all come to be, because I really enjoyed it and I'm buying the album. So
that's really nice to hear. Thank you. Yeah, I've been doing music longer than I actually have been designing. It's when I was a kid, of course, you know, when you grow up in the countryside, there's lots of fanfare bands and you learn an instrument and, you know, like I used to play flugelhorn when I grew up, then moved on to saxophone and played that for many, many years. I've got a whole selection of instruments at home that I kind of play in one way or another, various levels of badness probably, but music writing has always been something that really fascinated me, and I've always been composing and I've always been writing music, but I've never really released anything. And last year I was working with a friend of mine who is a really good musician herself, called Caroline Lavelle, and we were working on some songs and I was sending her some of my original stuff, and she was saying to me, you know, you should really start releasing these. And there's always that moment when you have a feeling like, am I good enough, or is this, you know,
right, yeah,
is this just a hobby? And thanks to people telling me that I should, for instance, start selling my patterns, that's how Modern Folk was born. And I thought, like, you know what, if Caroline says that I should release some music, then maybe I should. So
there's a pattern here of people saying, Jacob, you have talent, you need to show it.
Yeah, it looks like it. Yeah, but it is nice that when you have a really talented friend that supports you, and so yeah, I thought, like, you know what, I should do something with that. I've got a whole set of pieces now, and it really was good as well, because when you have the idea that you want to do an album, you really have to sit down. Most of the tracks were actually originally written for this idea, for this concept that I had with his album, and and that became Ivy, which is now out on CD, and I've actually bundled it together with a pattern on my website where people can buy the album and they're sent a free pattern that they can stitch up, which is also called the Ivy Green, so it sort of matches the title of the album. But yeah, it is. I don't know about you guys, but I really like listening to music when I do my stitching. So it's something that's really nice and calming. And the music itself, when I had finished it, I thought, like, you know what, actually, this is really nice to use as listening to this music while you stitch, because it's quite calming piano music. And I thought, like, you know what, I'm just going to sell it on the website as music to stitch my as well, so you can access it there as well. Yeah.
Well, it works. Well, Vana sings in her church choir, and I direct the handbell choir at our church. So
fantastic.
We're both musically oriented, at least to some degree. But it's all piano. What I heard is all piano. Is that you playing the piano?
It is indeed. No, it's actually not. I wish I could play the piano. I can play a few small, very, very simple things, but I'm not good enough to actually play the piano for real. There is amazing software now where you can program things, and the way you input the notes, and so you basically program it how you want it to be played, so with the slight delays and the notes getting louder and softer and the length of them and everything, you put everything into a computer, and then you have to go through a whole meticulous process of going note by note to make it all work as if someone is playing it. But sadly, I can't take credit for the playing in that way.
So what we're hearing is what you generated on a computer, or did someone actually perform that for you?
That's what I basically programmed in the computer, definitely, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Wow, because I thought it was you sitting at a piano.
No, it's but the good thing is as well, when sampler libraries have become really amazing, where you really get the sense of it actually being recorded, that makes a lot of difference as well, that you use the right samples and all these things. But you were saying that you play church, but the handbells, don't you?
I direct the handbell choir, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I absolutely love handbells, actually. Who knows for handbells?
Yeah, no, it's a great thing. It's so much fun. It's such a team effort, and yeah. and you talk about history. I mean, there's an instrument that has tremendous history, because it comes from in the old. Well, they still do it in Europe a lot. People get together in a bell tower with those bells way up at the top on ropes, and do change ringing patterns.
Yeah.
And it was, somebody said, wait a minute, instead of standing out in these bell towers in the winter freezing our butts off, we could use these little handbells and practice inside where it's comfortable. And then somebody said, well, wait a minute, we can make a bell for every note. We can play actual songs. And,
exactly.
Yeah, so it's
Italians that they have in the Netherlands as well, because the Netherlands and Belgium has beautiful church towers where they actually have a full keyboard with tiny bells, and right. Instead of playing your fingers, you actually have to play it with your fists, so they have to hit like these wooden things. It's quite fascinating, but we have a beautiful bell ringing team here in York as well, for the Minster Cathedral. That is one of the largest Gothic cathedrals in Europe.
A team of people who stand in a bell tower?
Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, it's, man.
There's several churches, but there's a lot of churches here in York, and there's several groups that do bell ringing here, and it's usually volunteer work. I've actually just learned that my father was a bell ringer my grandfather was a bell ringer in the village where I grew up, which I never knew, but I've just found that out a couple of months ago when I was in the Netherlands, and he would have to go to church early in the mornings to do the ringing and for special services and things like that. Yeah.
Oh, amazing. Yeah. No, the people who do those in the towers and can pull on those ropes and make those bells stay in sequence. That's amazing to me. I don't know how you do that. Not to mention be strong enough to do it for any length of time.
It's really complex, because how it works, it starts off in a really random pattern, and then you suddenly, they get into that, where it's ding, 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 and then it just goes on for a whole period of time. And it's properly, definitely, yeah. Yeah.
And don't they do that? I think that I have a friend in England who posted a video of the bell tower on the day after Easter, like on Easter Monday, where they had got... So it goes for a period of time, right? There, I mean, it's not like just dong, dong, dong. It's like a music pattern, and it goes for like 5, 10, 15 minutes, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's not just for Easter. It's in York. It's, I think it's every Sunday they do it.
Is that right?
But it's especially for special holidays. They're rung, special celebration, New Year's, they're rung, service, they're rung. So it's like special services. And especially when they practice, I don't think it's the most fun thing when you live next to a church when they... But it's beautiful when you walk past and you hear the bells ringing. But yeah, I don't think I would be pleased if they rang every morning.
from the other side of town is perfect.
If just far from the city center, that we hear them beautifully coming in from the distance.
Yeah.
And just lovely, yeah.
Yeah, it's one of the great things. It really is. Really is.
Absolutely.
All right, Jacob, I think we're just going to end on that, because now I have bells ringing in my head and I'm enjoying that. So I think we'll just end right there. Thanks so much for doing this with us. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much for having me. It was lovely talking to you guys. Yeah.
All right. Thanks to everybody for listening.